Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, March 15, 2024. The special prosecutor in the Georgia election interference criminal racketeering case against former President Donald Trump and his co-defendants Nathan Wade has resigned after a judge rules that either he or the district attorney, Fani Willis, must leave the case because their romantic relationship created an appearance of impropriety. The Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar visits Washington, D.C. ahead of St. Patrick's Day on Sunday, meeting with President Joe Biden at the White House and then attending the Congressional Friends of Ireland luncheon on Capitol Hill. But some in the Irish government are not sending representatives as part of the delegation in protest of the U.S. position in the war between Israel and Hamas and what they see as President Biden not doing enough to help the Palestinians in Gaza. Vice President Kamala Harris leads a discussion at the White House about cannabis and criminal justice reform. It's 1 week until another possible partial government shutdown. We'll speak to CQ Roll Call Appropriations and Budget reporter Aidan Quigley about the negotiations on six fiscal year 2024 spending bills, including for the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security. And as this Civic Learning Week comes to an end, we'll talk with Wesley Hedgepeth, president of the National Council for the Social Studies and a teacher in Virginia, about how students learn and practice civics and how that can be improved. Story from Associated Press, a special prosecutor who had a romantic relationship with Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis formally withdrew Friday from the Georgia election interference case against Donald Trump after a judge ruled one of them had to leave for the case to move forward. Attorney Nathan Wade's resignation allows Willis to remain on the most sprawling of the four criminal cases against the presumptive Republican nominee. In the 2024 presidential election, Wade offered his resignation in a letter to Willis, saying he was doing so in the interest of democracy, in dedication to the American public, and to move this case forward as quickly as possible. The resignation came hours after Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee said Wade had to be removed or Willis must step aside from the case. McAfee did not find Willis's relationship with Wade amounted to a conflict of interest, but said the allegations created an appearance of impropriety that infected the prosecution team. That was from Associated Press. C-SPAN spoke this morning about the ruling with Mike Davis, founder and president of the Article 3 Project.
It's a clearly legally wrong decision, but it doesn't surprise me with this judge. This is a young judge appointed by Governor Brian Kemp, who is certainly a Trump hater. This judge, Scott McAfee, is like 33 or 34 years old. He worked for Brian Kemp as the Georgia State Inspector General. He worked for Fani Willis in the Fulton County DA's office. He donated $150 to Fani Willis's campaign. There is very clear evidence that Fani Willis had an illegal financial stake in this criminal prosecution of President Trump. She hired her secret, unqualified boyfriend. She paid him $250 an hour to bring an unprecedented RICO charge against President Trump and 18 co-defendants. He billed $700,000 and counting. He billed for his time to collude with the Biden White House, including the Biden White House counsel twice before this indictment. He billed 24 hours on a single day. I don't know how that's possible. And then Nathan Wade took his girlfriend slash boss, Fani Willis, on these lavish trips to Napa Valley, the Caribbean, to Belize. That's bribery. Those are gift ban violations. That's an illegal financial stake in a criminal prosecution, which is absolutely illegal. She should have been disqualified. The entire office should have been disqualified if this Judge McAfee followed the facts and the law as he should have. There's no question she should have been disqualified and the office should have been disqualified. Frankly, the case should have been dismissed without prejudice for a new prosecutor to come in. But now that Judge McAfee faces a Democrat challenger, a Democrat judicial election challenger for this November in this overwhelmingly Democrat county of Fulton County, and I think he caved to the political pressure. You saw at this evidentiary hearing where he let Fani Willis run the show. He was scared to look at her. He couldn't keep her under control. And I think he just caved. He's young. He's scared. He caved to Fani Willis, his former boss.
Now, he did dismiss some of those charges against the former president this week as well. He still faces the larger issues, but dismissed some of those charges.
Yeah, that was window dressing. That was political. He made it look like he was trying to be even-handed and fair by dismissing charges that really don't matter that much. And so he dismissed charges that, you know, it looks like Nathan Wade wrote with a crayon and it's admitted because they're just so incomprehensible that they got dismissed, and they can refile those charges if Nathan Wade can get out the pen instead of the crayon and actually be a real lawyer here. But it's very obvious that this judge, Scott McAfee, caved to political pressure, and that's very unfortunate.
Mike Davis is founder and president of the Article 3 Project. He was on C-SPAN's morning program, Washington Journal, responding to the news, the ruling from the judge that either Nathan Wade or Fani Willis must go, and then Nathan Wade, the prosecutor, resigned, allowing the district attorney, Fulton County, Georgia, to continue with the election interference case against former President Donald Trump and the other co-defendants. Some more reaction to the ruling. Andrew Clyde, Republican of Georgia, posting on X, Judge McAfee's ruling is disappointing but not surprising. After all, he writes, he worked for Fani Willis and donated to her campaign. Clearly, corruption runs deep in Fulton County, Georgia. And Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, Democrat from Texas, posted this on X. Now bury this orange heathen under the jail. No election win for the presidency can protect him from being ordered to the Georgia Department of Corrections. Fani Willis and her office can continue their prosecution so long as Special Prosecutor Wade is removed. The decision is odd based upon the law, but honestly, this sounds like the judge exercising as much caution as possible to protect the record if and when Trump is convicted. I say give him his constitutional right for all 80-plus criminal counts, his right to a speedy trial. That post from Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, Democrat from Texas. This is Washington Today. USA Today has a story that a unanimous Supreme Court on Friday defined when the personal social media account of a public official is a government action, trying to settle whether constituents can be blocked from commenting or from following those accounts. A public official may block constituents, the court said, unless the official had the power to speak on the government's behalf and intended to do so through their personal social media account. The cases came out of Michigan and Southern California. From the Times of Israel, U.S. President Joe Biden will host Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar for the annual St. Patrick's Day reception at the White House, even as a portion of the usual Irish delegation boycotts the event over Biden's handling of the war in Gaza. President Biden did meet with the Taoiseach in the White House Oval Office.
Well, Taoiseach, welcome back to the Oval Office. It's good to have you back. And I want to thank you again for the reception I had when I was last in Ireland. As a matter of fact, my family wasn't sure we wanted to come home. It was so nice. Look, it's great to see you again. Great chance to return some of the hospitality that you provided me when I was in Ireland last. And I know there are all kinds of old Irish sayings, but my grandfather Finnegan used to say, may the hinge of our friendship never go rusty. He had all these sayings, you know, the Irish in America sometimes think they're more Irish than the Irish. But, and I don't think we're gonna let it go rusty. We're vital to each other's economies, we're good friends, and today celebrates 100 years.
That's right.
100 years. Diplomatic relations between Ireland and America. And as far as that friendship goes, it keeps increasing, not diminishing. And I'd argue stronger than ever. Together, we're deepening our economic partnership. There were 300,000, we helped create 300,000 jobs across both our nations. And we're working together to increase humanitarian assistance in Gaza, and we both know there's a whole lot more has to be done. And we're standing together to support Ukraine in the face of Putin's onslaught, the savagery with which he's attacking the Ukrainians. And I want to thank you, Leo, for Ireland's unwavering assistance to Ukraine, including millions of vital humanitarian aid that you provide, millions of dollars. And I'm urging our Congress to do its part, get back in the game if we were able to find another $300 million, but we have a $6 billion package, $60 billion package, and we really work it. So we're up on the hill. I'll ask you to lobby them for me.
I will.
That's a joke, okay. That's a joke. But I'm urging them in Congress to pass the bipartisan legislation now. It includes a significant amount of humanitarian aid, including to Ukraine and Gaza. And as I said in Belfast last year, we remain committed to protecting the peace and progress of Northern Ireland since the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. And like you, I'm glad to see Northern Ireland's executive and assembly are up and running. And I think that's, from my perspective, a very positive step forward. So, Leo, thank you again for being here. And as we begin the next century of our partnership and friendship, I've never been more optimistic because, you know, united by history, heritage, and hope, I think there's not a damn thing we can't do together. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you very much, Mr. President, and thanks for giving us so much time over these next few days. Very keen to talk about four main things while we're together. Since we last met back in New York briefly in September at the UN, and since your visit to Ireland last year, it's really good to see the institutions in Northern Ireland up and running. It just makes such a difference to have the Good Friday Agreement properly functioning. As you know, the Deputy First Minister are here, the Executive Assembly are operating. We'll have our North South Ministerial Council meeting next month, and the British-Irish Council in June. So really good to see the promise of that agreement, that Good Friday Agreement, being fulfilled again, which is such a positive change since the last time we met. As you mentioned, we've celebrating 100 years of diplomatic relations. The US is one of the first countries to recognize Irish independence, and it's become such a strong relationship since then. I'm very keen to talk about that a bit more, and also the strength of our economic relationship now, which increasingly goes both ways. There's now 100,000 Americans working in firms that are Irish owned here in the US, and we're one of the top 10 investors in the US now, so great to be able to repay some of that interest. Obviously keen to talk about the situation in Gaza as well. You'll know my view that we need to have a ceasefire as soon as possible to get food and medicine in, to get the hostages out. And we need to talk about how we can make that happen and move towards a two-state solution, which I think is the only way we'll have lasting peace and security. And then on Ukraine, just really want to thank you and America for your leadership on Ukraine. We're very worried about the situation there. And we don't think that if Putin is successful in Ukraine, he'll stop there. And we really need your continued support and leadership on Ukraine, and look forward to speaking to the congressional leaders about that as well later on. And we'll have a European Council meeting next week of the 27 EU prime ministers. So they're going to be very keen to know what I learned here in Washington. And that's a fight we've got to win.
You can tell them that the President of the United States is strongly committed to making sure we provide that aid. Well, thank you very much. We'll get a chance to bring in our delegations, and thank you all for being here, folks.
Do you have any comments, sir, on Senator Schumer's speech on Israel yesterday?
Senator Schumer contacted my staff, my senior staff. He's going to make that speech, and I'm not going to elaborate on the speech. He made a good speech, and I think he expressed a serious concern shared not only by him but by many Americans.
In the White House Oval Office, President Joe Biden and the Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar. IrishNews.com writes that the Premier, Leo Varadkar, has called on the U.S. to work with Ireland to push for peace in the Middle East as he began a series of high-profile events in Washington. He has been urged by a former Irish president to urge the U.S. to stop sending arms and funds to Israel during two bilateral meetings planned with U.S. President Joe Biden. The St. Patrick's Day traditional trip to the U.S. is split into two this year, meaning that Mr. Varadkar will meet with Mr. Biden on Friday at the White House and again on Sunday for the Shamrock Bowl ceremony. That from Irish News. And CBS News has an article about the visit that has this paragraph. Ireland has long been considered one of the biggest proponents of the Palestinian people's call for an end to Israeli occupation and statehood, partly due to what the Irish public sees as parallels in the two peoples' histories. The history of British occupation still leaves an indelible mark on the collective Irish psyche. That was from CBS News. The Irish Prime Minister and President Biden, after their White House meeting, then went to the U.S. Capitol for the annual Friends of Ireland luncheon. That St. Patrick's Day luncheon, hosted by House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to everyone. Now, I know it's not quite St. Patrick's Day, but most of us are not quite Irish either. Okay, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. It doesn't stop us from celebrating in this cherished annual tradition. I do want to say I do have some bona fides, Congressman Kelly, on the Irish thing. I married one, anyway. My wife, Kelly, who you know, is definitely Irish. Her maiden name is Larry, L-A-R-Y, and that shortened generations ago from O'Leary. And then we traced her lineage, in fact, for this event. And she's actually from the O'Rear family. We knew that much, but we didn't know they immigrated to the United States in the late 17th century and wound up in our home state of Louisiana. So we've always cherished that side of the family and the fun part, we call it, the Irish side, because Americans love the Irish culture. And St. Patrick's Day, of course, is a great time to commemorate the special relationship between our two nations. Americans love the culture and the land and the lore of Ireland. And this lunch started, as all of you know, between President Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, two great Irishmen who are serving in American politics, and they wanted to make a statement about the solidarity between the two countries. And in 1984, President Reagan visited Ballyporeen, the hometown of his great-grandfather. And he and Nancy stopped in at O'Farrell's and had a pint of Smithix at the very appropriately named Ronald Reagan Lounge. In 2002, this is a pretty neat part of the story. The Ronald Reagan Presidential Library bought that pub, they took it apart piece by piece, and they transported it out to Simi Valley. And it's true, as the story goes, when the pub came out of the shipping container, you could still smell the old beer and cigarettes. I mean, it's very authentic, very authentic. And thanks to the generosity of the Reagan Foundation and the Reagan Museum, I have the honor of using that very glass today, the very glass that President Reagan drank from at O'Farrell's in 1984. It's pretty awesome. I think, oh, here it is, okay. Now, I'm a Southern Baptist, so they filled it with O'Doul's, just in case anybody's watching. But this is a great honor. This is the glass that Reagan used. Please join me as we celebrate the relationship between Ireland and the United States and remember the legacy of St. Patrick, who once prayed this, and then we'll drink. May God's might uphold you. May God's wisdom guide you. May God's eye look before you. May God's ear hear you. May God's word speak to you. May God's hand guard you. May God's way lie before you. And may God's shield protect you. Cheers.
House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, at the Friends of Ireland luncheon on Capitol Hill, attended by President Joe Biden and the Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar. The President and the Prime Minister also made remarks, and we've got the full ceremony, or celebration, at our video library at cspan.org. The U.S. Census says that 31.5 million Americans, 9.5%, claimed Irish ancestry in 2021. From NBC News, Vice President Kamala Harris will hold the administration's first public event on marijuana reform this week after President Joe Biden addressed the issue as one of his priorities in last week's State of the Union address. Harris will convene a roundtable discussion in the West Wing featuring Grammy-nominated artist Fat Joe, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, individuals who received pardons for prior cannabis convictions. Harris's main portfolio includes reproductive health care, gun violence, and voting rights, but she has consistently amplified criminal justice reform since her years as a district attorney in California. In the State of the Union address, President Biden said that he had directed his cabinet to review the federal classification of marijuana, adding that he's also expunging thousands of convictions for the mere possession, because no one should be jailed for simply using. That was from NBC News. Here's Vice President Kamala Harris opening the meeting.
We have gathered today, however, to address specifically the injustices that we have seen in federal marijuana policy. I have said many times, I think we all at this table believe, nobody should have to go to jail for smoking weed. And what we need to do is recognize that far too many people have been sent to jail for simple marijuana possession. And the impact is such that, in particular, Black Americans and Latinos are four times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession. And the disparity is even larger when you talk about the subset of Black men and Latino men. So this is an issue that must be addressed. It is work that, again, I've done over the years. It is work that we are also doing as an administration. First, I will tell you that we have pardoned tens of thousands of people with federal convictions for simple marijuana possession. And today we are joined by some of the pardon recipients so that we can have a conversation about what this has meant for them as a model and inspiration for what we must do for many others who are not at this table. And their stories, I will tell you, are proof of the importance of pardons and what it means in the life of an individual in terms of allowing them a second chance and an ability to reenter their community in a productive way. Second, we have issued a call to action for states to pardon these types of offenses, in particular on possession. That is why I've asked the governor of Kentucky to be here, Governor Beshear, who has basically pardoned and has addressed the convictions of people in Kentucky with simple marijuana possession convictions, and they can now apply for pardon. So he's going to talk with us about that as a model for what other states can and should do, and I challenge other states to follow his lead. Third, we have directed the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice to reassess how marijuana is classified under the federal drug schedule. And I cannot emphasize enough that they need to get to it as quickly as possible, and we need to have a resolution based on their findings and their assessment. But this issue is stark when one considers the fact that on the schedule currently, marijuana is considered as dangerous as heroin. Marijuana is considered as dangerous as heroin and more dangerous than fentanyl, which is absurd, not to mention patently unfair. So I'm sure DA is working as quickly as possible and will continue to do so, and we look forward to the product of their work. And with that, I will conclude by saying that the work that we have achieved thus far is important, but there still is much more to do. And I thank the participants who are at this table. And Governor, again, I want to thank you for your leadership, and Fat Joe for moderating our discussion today. And with that, I thank the press. Have a good afternoon.
Vice President Kamala Harris at the White House, starting that roundtable discussion on cannabis and criminal justice reform. Story from Reuters, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Friday called for greater international cooperation to fight the booming trafficking of illicit synthetic drugs such as fentanyl, the leading cause of overdose deaths in his country. He was speaking at the annual meeting of the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs, which reviews global drug regulations and each year adds new so-called precursor chemicals, ingredients used to make illicit drugs, to international lists known as schedules to place strict controls on their trade. That was from Reuters. Here is the secretary in Austria.
We've seen the scourge of synthetic drugs touch virtually every town, every city, every state in the United States. More than 40% of the American people know someone who died from an opioid overdose. The number one killer of Americans between the ages of 18 and 45 is fentanyl. So the impact that this has had cannot be overstated. And on something like fentanyl, we've been something of a canary in the coal mine. It hit us hard, it hit us first, but now we're seeing as markets are saturated, criminal enterprises trying to make markets in other parts of the world. And so what came to us one day, alas, may be coming to you another. And of course, there are many other synthetic drugs that are already afflicting so many countries in this room. Those numbers are almost hard to digest. So I'd ask you to think for just a moment, not so much of the numbers, but what they represent, of all the losses that they contain, all the pain experienced by loved ones and friends, all the empty seats left in classrooms and at dinner tables, or in businesses, places of worship, all the contributions those hundreds of thousands of people might have made to our shared world if they were still alive. Now, think about all the people who will live longer, healthier, more secure lives with greater opportunity if we achieve what we set out to do, if we come together to surmount the profound threats posed by synthetic drugs, if we prevent more citizens, more communities from being consumed by this crisis.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the UN Commission on Narcotic Drugs meeting in Austria. The United States and allies warned Iran on Friday, writes Associated Press, that major Western economies will pile new sanctions on Tehran if it moves forward with an advancing plan to provide ballistic missiles to Russia for its war with Ukraine. John Kirby, the White House National Security Communications Advisor, spoke about this at the White House news conference.
We have expressed serious concerns from this podium that Russia is seeking to acquire close-range ballistic missiles from Iran to enable its brutal war in Ukraine. And that Russian negotiations to acquire those close-range ballistic missiles have been active and they've been advancing. Today, I just want to call your attention to a joint statement released this morning by the United States and other G7 countries warning Iran not to go forward with the sale of close-range ballistic missiles to Russia. The G7 statement reads in part, and I quote, "Were Iran to proceed with providing ballistic missiles or related technology to Russia, we are prepared to respond swiftly and in a coordinated manner, including with new and significant measures against Iran," end quote. So we're speaking with one voice here on this matter, from the United States, Canada, Japan, the EU, France, Germany, and the United Kingdom.
John Kirby, White House National Security Communications Advisor at today's news conference. Associated Press article says the one action the group of seven countries are mulling is to prohibit Iran Air, the country's national air carrier, from flying to Europe. According to a senior Biden administration official, the official was not authorized to comment and insisted on anonymity, declined to preview other sanctions that the U.S. is mulling beyond describing the potential action as significant measures. In a story from Reuters, Vladimir Putin accused Ukraine on Friday of trying to disrupt a Russian presidential election that is virtually certain to hand him six more years in the Kremlin, and said Moscow would punish Kyiv for its latest attacks. The first of 3 days of voting was marked by disruptions, including dye being poured into ballot boxes, a Molotov cocktail thrown at a polling station in Putin's hometown, and reported cyber attacks. "These enemy strikes will not remain unpunished," a visibly angry Putin said in a meeting of Russia's Security Council. That from Reuters. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi, I'm Tammy, and joining me today is Paul, as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Tammy. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach. So no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
And as we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
Here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. It's free, or wherever you find your podcasts. Story from CNN, Congress is running up on yet another critical government funding deadline on March 22nd, with 1 week to go before the potential partial shutdown of several critical departments. Negotiators are still working furiously around the clock to finish their work on the remaining six bills. And so the federal government has once more begun the mandatory process of planning to bring the affected agency's non-essential functions to a halt 1 week from Friday. If this feels familiar, writes CNN, that's because this is the fifth time since September that lawmakers have run up against a funding deadline, passing stopgap bills in the nick of time in September, November, January, and earlier this month to keep the government running. House Speaker Mike Johnson said at a news conference at the House Republican Policy Retreat in West Virginia on Wednesday that he does not believe there will be a partial government shutdown.
We live in challenging times. We live in a time of divided government. Democracy is messy. Sometimes it's very messy. This is part of that process. But I think what you've seen is that even though we live in a time of divided government, and even though the Republicans have quite literally almost the smallest majority in U.S. history, in an effort that some deem to be impossible, we are actually moving the ball forward and getting the job done. We are governing. We passed the first six bills, the first appropriations bills, as you know. The second batch is due by March 22nd. I believe we're going to meet that deadline. Some very deliberative work has been done. And the House, while you might describe it as chaotic, the Republican-led majority has gotten a lot of really important substantive work done. Not just all of the oversight, that's a very important constitutional responsibility for us, but passing very important and meaningful legislation.
House Speaker Mike Johnson.
Aiden Quigley joins us. He reports on the budget and appropriations for CQ Roll Call. And Aiden, as the government faces another partial shutdown on March 22nd, where do things stand?
Yeah, so right now, it seems like we're in pretty good shape to avoid a shutdown and to finally wrap up full year fiscal 2024 appropriations. It's been a long time coming. You know, October 1 was the start of this fiscal year, and we're in the middle of March. But as of right now, it looks like we're trending towards bill release of the final six bills for fiscal 2024 to be released over the weekend, which would put us on track to passage by Friday, which is the deadline. Friday at midnight would be the shutdown deadline. But I expect that we will hopefully be done by then and be moving forward.
And you report on some of the major sticking points, especially with Homeland Security. The House wants $2.1 billion for a border wall, the Senate zero, and the Senate wants appropriations of $752 million to shelter migrants. The House provides $0 for that. Tell us more about the negotiators separating out Homeland Security. What is the plan there, and why did they do it that way?
Yeah, so, you know, after Speaker Johnson and Majority Leader Schumer announced a top-line deal in January, appropriators kind of split up the money into the 12 separate bills. Homeland was going to see a slim 1% to 2% increase in funding, but they just hit a wall. You know, they've been negotiating since January, trying to come up with a way to spread that money out. The two parties just could not reach an agreement, mainly because of the big policy differences and how they want to spend money. You pointed out some of the major ones. You know, obviously, Republicans and Democrats have very different views over how, you know, migrants at the border should be treated and the approach to that. So, you know, essentially, they were working hard to try to reach an agreement and, you know, an increase, but they hit a wall. Negotiations fell apart this week. So instead, they're going to do a full year continuing resolution for Homeland, which will keep the fiscal 2023 funding levels and policies in place until the end of the fiscal year 24 in at the end of September.
And without the penalty that they sort of had put in place in order to get to that agreement, right?
Yeah, so in the debt limit law, there was this little provision that really had kind of major impact, you know, major effect on the appropriations process, at least through kind of the planning and scheduling of it, where if there was a temporary continuing resolution in place, you could have 1% hit. If it's very, very complicated, but essentially you would have a sequester of some sort if you hit April 30th without full year appropriations in place. But this is extremely important to note. There's been a lot of confusion about this. This full year Homeland CR would count as a full year appropriations, according to the lawmakers who are writing it. Obviously, OMB, which is the president's budget office, gets to decide, but everyone expects them to rule it as a full year bill to avoid the sequester. And we will just be moving on, avoiding that scenario, which neither party wanted. You know, at first it seemed like it would, you know, Republicans were slightly better situated as it would be a kind of major cut to non-defense programs if it did enact. But then with the passage of the first six bills in non-defense, at this point, it would hit defense harder. So no one wants it, and we're moving forward.
And just briefly, what about Ukraine and Israel aid? How are those considerations affecting the agreement on these six remaining spending bills?
Yeah, so at this point, it looks like that package that the Senate passed, it could come up in the House. It seemed like this week on the Republican retreat, there was some reporting that Speaker Johnson is kind of more talking about that a little more as a possibility. But when it comes to the fiscal 2024 process, I think the understanding that that would just complicate passage, and you know, you need two-thirds of the House to pass these major spending bills, and that already might be a little tricky based on some of the more controversial issues that may or may not be in these, in this package. So I think that we will see that after and not before March 22nd. They're about to leave for April, Easter recess. So that would put us into April when they could bring back up this supplemental spending bill, but it's not going to be attached to this upcoming package.
Aidan Quigley, budget and appropriations reporter for CQ Roll Call. Appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me.
On Wall Street today, the Dow down 190, NASDAQ down 155, S&P down 3. This is Civic Learning Week, which according to iCivic's website is to make civic learning a nationwide priority for a stronger democracy. iCivic's works with educators, students, and other members of the community in programs reflecting the significance of civics, opening up opportunities for discussions and learning experiences to promote the teaching of civics. Joining us on the phone now is Wesley Hedgepath, current president of the National Council for the Social Studies and a AP Comparative Politics, U.S. Government, and World History teacher at Collegiate School in Henrico County, Virginia. Thanks for being with us. What is the National Council for the Social Studies, and how does it connect to civics instruction?
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having me today. So the National Council for the Social Studies is the largest organization within the United States dedicated solely to social studies education. And we have members within all 50 states, D.C., as well as 35 countries around the world. We serve as an umbrella organization for elementary, secondary, and college teachers of history, civics, geography, economics, political science, et cetera. There are lots of disciplines within the social studies, and so civics is one of those that we, of course, part of our mission, advocate for and build capacity for high quality instruction. So we are providing leadership services and support to educators in civics, but also all of the other disciplines.
As you travel to state social studies conferences and through communications at the state level, how is the subject of teaching civics being approached in the K through 12 classrooms?
That's a great question. As you might imagine, we'll have lots of different answers to that question based off of where you are within the country. However, there have been kind of two different camps, if you will, that I've noticed in the approaches to civic education. There is the approach that encourages rote memorization, such as encouraging the nationalization test that is given to those that are seeking citizenship here. That is the approach in some states and localities to have students pass that as part of their accountability for civics ed within their particular area. That's not what necessarily I'm advocating for as the president of NCSS and the association more broadly. We advocate for an inquiry-based approach where the students are learning skills along with the content, that there is a balance. And what they're doing is that they're examining our human experience through the generation of questions, collection and analysis of evidence from credible sources, considering multiple perspectives, and applying that knowledge to something that that's relevant to their everyday life. So we're hoping that, you know, Our vision at NCSS is really where we have a world where all students are educated and inspired for lifelong learning, lifelong inquiry, and informed civic action. And so we're hoping that that more states, more schools are supporting students in this way, giving them real-life examples, real-life practice when they're in the safety of a classroom. So then that way they're more apt to participate in civic life when they leave. So as an example, you know, students would maybe they're investigating a problem that's existing within their particular town or their space. And so they want to investigate that. They will use skills within our discipline, such as research, critical thinking, collaboration, corroboration. And they will then analyze sources, come up with a solution. And maybe that solution is going and speaking to their city council or their board of supervisors and requesting some action on the issue that they have researched and, again, are informed about before they take action and are under the guidance of a social studies professional. So that was a long-winded answer to your question, but that's the type of civics education that we support. However, there is, like I said, another approach to that, which favors rote memorization.
We're talking with Wesley Hedgepath, president of the National Council for the Social Studies. Besides the approach, what other changes would you make to ensure young people are being prepared to become civically engaged citizens? What are we getting wrong now?
Right. Well, I think that we as adults aren't very good at having conversations with one another and listening to one another. And so we're seeing that shown in the classroom as well, where our kids are coming to us without the skills to be able to disagree with one another and to be able to articulate a claim that is supported by evidence. And so one of the things that one of the tools that we can use for civic education to improve it is to give students that practice of civil dialogue. Is the teacher creating norms with the kids? Are they reviewing those norms regularly? Is the teacher providing speaking stems, so sentence starters, so the students have some help in approaching a disagreement with a classmate? Or maybe they are having difficulty articulating their own point. Are these types of practices regular? Is it okay also to disagree with your neighbor and to recognize nuance between the different sides? Yes, and that's something that we need to also be considerate of, is that there's not always a binary answer. There's a lot of nuance, and in our political system, we often show it as a binary between one of two parties. And so that, I believe, is another way that we could improve civic education.
And finally, where can students, educators, and the public go for support on civic learning?
So we would hope that educators would come to the National Council for the Social Studies for support with civic learning and really all disciplines. But our affiliates across the country as well are excellent resources for that. I'm at the Wisconsin Council for the Social Studies Conference right now in Madison, and there are excellent sessions that are going on as we speak on civil dialogue, on media literacy, on data literacy, on fact-checking, on ways to practice informed civic action, so then that way they can later on do that as active citizens within their space. So the NCSS, as well as our affiliates, are a definite resource for practitioners, for teachers. Our partners, iCivics, right? They're the sponsors of Civic Learning Week, as you said, and we're proud co-sponsors of that event. There are a lot of games that, in fact, I use in my AP U.S. Government class that iCivics put together, that are simulations and that make civic learning fun for kids. And so that's another place that parents could also go to, right? These are resources that are free if they're looking to engage and learn themselves. But those are, the places that I feel like are really important. But there's also state affiliates of civic, champions of civic ed too. Like Virginia Civics is a really excellent resource for parents, for community members at large, and in particular for teachers and students.
Wesley Hedgepath, president of the National Council for the Social Studies and a teacher in Henrico County, Virginia. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.